Darkcast Network. Indie pods with a dark side.
December 12, 1990 was the night before Noreen Brown's 32nd birthday. Late that night, the mother of two told her husband she was running out to the grocery store to buy ingredients for Christmas cookies. She grabbed some cash and got into her station wagon. The following morning, her car was found in the Pathmark parking lot a mile from her home. It was locked, and there were Christmas presents wrapped inside, but Noreen Higuchi Brown was never seen again. Her case quickly went cold, but the people who loved Noreen never gave up searching for answers, even when it seemed as though the rest of the world had moved on. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell you the stories of those who never came home. Today, I want to tell you the story of Noreen Higuchi Brown. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Welcome back, everyone.
Welcome back.
Thank you for joining us once again. I'm Kona.
And I'm Ethan.
And we're the husband and wife team behind this podcast. Each week, I tell you the story of an unsolved missing persons case. Ethan doesn't know anything about the case going into the episode and is here to provide his reactions and questions in real time, hopefully asking some of the same ones you have at home. Noreen's case made me think of one that we covered last season, the local one of Layla McCullough. Like Layla, Noreen was a wife and mother who disappeared, and police just kind of shrugged their shoulders. There's barely any sort of investigation done into Noreen's disappearance in 1990, and her case quickly fell off the radar, which it's shameful. She was the mother of two very young children, and the police just gave up. But Noreen's story also has hope, because a group of her high school friends refused to forget her and have dedicated themselves to finding out what happened to their friend. Before we get started, though, we've had some new people join us over on Patreon, so we'd like to take a moment to give them a little bit of a shout-out. Thank you to Vicky, Emily G, and Nana V. We really appreciate your support.
Thank you all so much.
As a reminder, if you'd like to get our episodes ad-free and early, you can join us over on Patreon at any level, starting at just $2 a month. You'll also get a free copy of the ebook that I wrote. Now, let's get into the story of Noreen Higuchi Brown. Noreen Higuchi was born on December 13, 1958, to Margot and Don Higuchi. She grew up in Uniondale on Long Island, New York, and was the second of four children. Her mother, Margot, was a German immigrant who worked as a seamstress and a housekeeper. Her father, Don, was Japanese-American and owned a carpet store. Noreen was the type of person that people gravitated toward. She was also a serious athlete who excelled at swimming, gymnastics, skiing, and judo.
Wow.
Yeah. Susan Higuchi Mule, Noreen's younger sister, put it simply, quote, "Everyone loved Noreen," end quote. Noreen attended Uniondale High School, and after she graduated, she worked briefly in an office and then at a bank. At some point, she met a man named John Brown. John was a New York City firefighter, and he also ran a plumbing supply business on the side. They married and started a family. Their son Anthony came first, followed by a baby girl, Alexa, about a year later. In December 1990, Anthony was 18 months old, and Alexa was just 5 months old, putting Noreen deep in the trenches of early parenthood with two babies under two.
Yikes.
Yeah.
That's tough.
Yes. I know people do it all the time, but I still cannot imagine.
No, neither can I.
But she was exactly where she wanted to be. Noreen loved being a mother. Her friend Elaine Commando told Dateline, quote, "She was a terrific mother. Her kids were her whole life," end quote. At the time she vanished, the family was living in kind of an in-between situation. They were staying in an apartment above the plumbing supply store that John owned while they were renovating a new house that they bought nearby. On the surface, they seemed like any other couple living on Long Island trying to balance home, work, and family. But underneath the surface, as Noreen's friends would find, things weren't as happy as they seemed. In a 2019 interview with News 12 Long Island, Noreen's friend Elaine Commando said that at a dinner in late 1990, Noreen told her and their other friend Kelly that her marriage was not what it looked like from the outside and that she wasn't happy. Elaine says that she was actually surprised to hear that because it was the first that she had heard of problems between the couple. But just a few weeks after that dinner, Noreen was gone. December 12th, 1990 was the day before Noreen's 32nd birthday. She spent the day doing what a lot of moms were busy doing at the time. That afternoon, she went Christmas shopping with her two kids and her sister, and they even stopped to take pictures with Santa Claus.
How many tears were there?
I'm sure a few. Then Noreen dropped Susan off in Franklin Square and drove back home to New Hyde Park. That evening, according to John, the couple had what he later described as a minor argument. And then, sometime around 11 p.m., Noreen decided to make a late grocery run to Pathmark to get ingredients for Christmas cookies.
This already isn't adding up. What? 11 p.m. trip to the grocery store when you've got two kids under two.
Well, I can kind of understand it because from what it sounds like, she liked to do these late night grocery runs, especially if John was home and could stay with the kids, because then she could go have some time to herself without having to take the kids grocery shopping. Plus, like, the grocery stores are dead at 11 p.m., so she doesn't have to deal with the crowds. Like, I mean, I buy it because I can understand that as just like a way to get some alone time.
If that's something that she normally did, yeah.
Well, that's the question, right? Because I think John said that it is something she normally did for those reasons I just mentioned. But when Elaine, her friend, was interviewed in 2019, she told the reporter that she had never known Noreen to do that. But again, I mean, something like grocery shopping late at night, you would think her husband would know the pattern more than a friend.
Sure, or the husband's using it as a cover-up.
Well, yeah. So in any case, the story is that Noreen grabbed some cash in her purse but left her wallet with her ID in it at home. John says that he fell asleep on the couch not long after and didn't realize that Noreen never came back. He says that he woke up around 5 a.m. and it was only then that he realized.
And he just happens to be the, like, luckiest father that he's got two kids under two that
slept through the night. That was my exact thought. Because I remember 5 months being a particularly unhappy time when it comes to sleeping.
Even 18 months?
Yeah.
Like, they don't typically sleep the entire night.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, sometimes they do, of course. But yeah, a lot of times they wake up, the diaper's wet, you know,
right. They
need something, they had a dream, like whatever it is. So yeah, that's funny that you picked up on that immediately because so did I. So I don't know what happened between 5 a.m. when he says he woke up and 8 a.m., but according to Elaine, that friend, John's mother had come over to their apartment at some point that morning. Because at 8 a.m. on December 13th, Noreen's birthday, John called Elaine and asked if Noreen had maybe spent the night at her house. I think that the idea here is that he's like, well, we had this argument. Maybe after she went to Pathmark, she just went to Elaine's house and didn't come home. And, you know, this is like nobody had cell phones or anything at this point.
Sure.
So we should point that out. And then from what Elaine was saying, I don't know if John told her on the phone that his mother was at the house or if she, like, you know, heard her in the background or however that was. But Elaine is the one who says that John's mother was at the apartment that morning when he called her. So anyway, as I'm sure you guessed, Noreen hadn't gone to Elaine's house to spend the night. Elaine hadn't heard from her and had no idea where she was. You know, I don't know. I have a hard time with the 5 a.m. to 8 a.m.
Yeah.
Time
frame.
I mean,
like, what was he doing?
Yeah, no idea. And, you know, maybe you're busy with the kids, like maybe you're doing whatever and just assuming she's going to come back. I can also make the case for, you know, again, we don't have cell phones, so we couldn't contact Noreen directly. If he genuinely thought he was at Elaine's house, maybe he was just being polite by not calling Elaine at 5 a.m.
But, I mean, was this typical behavior after an argument? Because, like, as you pointed out, it was only recently that Noreen had told Elaine that their marriage was kind of rocky.
Right.
So,
yeah.
it's not necessarily something that she would have typically done. So it seems odd to me that this would have been like a one-off occurrence, and he's mm-hmm. like, ah, I'm just going to let her go blow off steam, actually knowing where she is.
Yeah, I think that is actually a pretty good point, because you're right. And Maureen was she had friends. So is it possible that she could have done this before at another friend's house? Sure. But Elaine has spoken so extensively about this that I think had Maureen ever come to her house like that before, she would have mentioned it
right
down the line.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, I mean, everything indicates that this is not normal behavior for Maureen. And you're right. I mean, yeah, like it seems like you would be maybe a little bit more freaked out.
Yeah. I mean,
if you're
I would
the husband.
Be.
Yeah. If I just didn't show up, like, because I was pissed with you.
Yeah. I mean, that happened a lot with my first wife. But she wasn't even pissed at me.
All right. Well, that's a whole other rabbit hole. But yeah. But I think that is important because, yeah, even if you're making the argument that he was just being polite to Elaine and not calling, like, why? You know, like, it seems like he would have been a little bit more concerned.
Yeah.
All right. So in any case, it took him till 8 a.m. to call Elaine. But the next part is what really strikes me as odd. So they're on the phone, right? Elaine says, no, I have no idea where Noreen is. Have not heard from her. He tells Elaine the pathmark story, right? John then asks Elaine to drive over to the pathmark to see if Noreen's car was in the parking lot.
Why wouldn't he?
Well, that's my question. Because when I initially read that, because, you know, again, anytime I'm looking at a new case, I'm like reading a short summary on it somewhere, right? That only gives the high level points. And the high level points is that John called Elaine, asked her to go down to the pathmark. So just knowing that, I was like, okay, well, you know, they did have two young kids. Maybe he just asked her to do it because it was easier for her to do it instead of him like getting the kids together and, you know.
Except that his mom was there.
Exactly, which I didn't find out, you know, until I looked into it further when I was actually doing the research for the episode. So, yeah, knowing that his mom was there, why didn't he? And then going back to what I was saying about the 8 a.m. phone call, and I, you know, I don't know when his mom got there. His mom could have just walked in the door right before he called Elaine.
Sure.
But like, if she was there a little bit earlier, to me, it seems like he would have been in the car driving around.
Yeah.
Going to the pathmark, driving, because the pathmark's only a mile from their house, right? So like driving that route in between the pathmark and their house, like thinking, you know, just doing something. If you are trying to be polite and wait till a decent hour before you call Elaine.
Right.
But yeah, so I don't know. So
but asking her.
Yeah.
It's almost, and I'm perhaps jumping the gun here, but it's almost deliberate in the sense that he didn't want to be the first one to find her car.
Exactly. That's exactly what it feels
further
like.
Further implicates him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He wanted the car to be found by someone else. Like, that is absolutely the feeling that I get from this whole scenario.
All right. I have a lot of questions about the pathmark, but I'll.
Well, let me tell you a little bit more about the pathmark.
Okay.
Because I might answer at least one of those questions here in a second.
My first question is, what is a pathmark?
Oh, you don't know what a pathmark is?
No. Okay. I've never heard of that.
Sorry. It is a grocery store chain in the New York, New Jersey area.
Okay.
Yeah. So, like, when I lived in Jersey City, like, that was my local grocery store. Was
normal grocery store.
Totally normal, just average grocery store. It was in a strip mall. Yeah, just picture every grocery store in a strip mall you've ever seen.
Yep.
And there you go. So, when Elaine arrived at the pathmark, it didn't take her long to find Noreen's car. It, as I mentioned in the intro, it was locked, and inside were the wrapped Christmas presents from her shopping trip the day before. And, you know, all of this seems to track with John's story.
Grocery bags in the car? No.
No.
Okay.
But here's the next fact that really bothers me. The car was parked at the far end of the lot, not right in front of the store.
Outside of camera.
Well, there weren't, from what I've heard from what police have said over the years, I don't think the pathmark had cameras at all.
Interesting.
At least outside. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they probably had some inside, but it doesn't sound like they really had any outside in the parking lot. But yeah, even if they did, you're right. They did not. There definitely were no cameras in that section of the parking lot whatsoever. And you know, here's the thing that bothers me about it is that this trip to the Pathmark was supposedly at 11 p.m. Like, right. No woman is going to be on fucking Long Island parking at the ass end of the parking lot at 11 p.m. at night.
A dark parking lot.
Like, that's absurd.
Yeah.
Like, it's not going to happen.
And at 11 o'clock at night, you can't even say, oh, the parking lot was full or must have been full.
That's my point. You know, like, if this had been a daytime trip and they found her car and it's at the end of the parking lot, okay, whatever. Like, you could explain that in a million different ways.
Yeah.
But there's absolutely no earthly reason why Noreen would have parked there. She was just going there to buy Christmas cookies. Now, you can make the argument that she parked there because she was meeting somebody and didn't want to draw attention.
Sure.
You know, I'm not saying there's only one explanation, but like one explanation that it isn't is that that's just where she decided to park to go get Christmas cookies.
Mm-hmm. Where you park if you're dumping a car.
Yeah. And that odd detail of where that car was parked is something that Elaine also picked up on immediately. So that morning, after she found the car, she went inside the store and called John back from the store phone. He came down and met her in the parking lot. He then called police, and police came, but according to Elaine, told John that he had to wait 24 hours before he could make a missing persons report.
24 hours from when she went missing or 24 hours from when he discovered her not being home?
I don't know. But either way, it's absurd because like even if you're looking at John's story and taking it at face value, like it's not good.
Right.
You know, like you have a woman who's alone, who's the mother of two kids, who pops out to go to the grocery store late at night and doesn't come back. Like,
right.
That is an alarming situation that you shouldn't have to wait 24 hours to investigate.
Well, they were just waiting for her body to turn up.
I mean, seriously. Now, I mentioned that the Pathmark didn't have cameras, but an employee later said that they did recall seeing Noreen's station wagon sometime after 11 p.m. And I don't know if the circumstances are this is, you know, like maybe when that employee was getting off of work, seeing a car parked weirdly at the bottom of the lot. You know, I don't remember the exact circumstances, but the employee did confirm seeing the car there that night.
The car, not Noreen.
Not Noreen. Nobody reported seeing Noreen in or around the Pathmark that night. And investigators have never been able to confirm that she was ever actually there. Y'all, I've been on the internet for a long time, and I have so many different logins on so many different websites. But sometimes you see a purple button at the top of the payment options, and it makes everything so much easier. You can just complete your checkout with the tap of one button. So you already know I'm talking about Shopify. Shopify is the commerce platform behind millions of businesses around the world and 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., from household names like Heinz and Skims to brands just getting started. With hundreds of ready-to-use templates, Shopify helps you build a beautiful online store that matches your brand style. And you can get the word out like you have a whole marketing team behind you, even if it's just you. You can easily create email and social media campaigns wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling. See less carts go abandoned and more sales go with Shopify and their Shop Pay button. Sign up for your $1 per month trial today at shopify.com/ATTWG. Go to shopify.com/ATTWG. That's shopify.com/ATTWG. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. Financial stress pushes people to desperate decisions, and a lack of financial literacy is what makes people, especially kids and teens, easy targets. Teaching your kids about money isn't just smart parenting, it's protection. Greenlight is a debit card and app for families, but it's more than just a money tool. It's a safety net. Greenlight gives you real-time notifications the second your child swipes their card, but it goes beyond money. Parents can get place alerts when kids come and go from school, activities, or home. Driving safety features help you understand risky behavior behind the wheel with crash detection if something serious happens. And if your child ever feels unsafe, SOS alerts make sure help is just a tap away. Ethan and I have been Greenlight customers for years. We use it for our two older boys, so we've seen firsthand how helpful it is for kids to have that autonomy and financial literacy from an early age. So join us and the millions of parents and kids already using Greenlight, the number one family finance and safety app. Every day they're handling money without guidance is a missed opportunity. Start your risk-free Greenlight trial today at greenlight.com/ATTWG. Don't wait to teach your kids real-world money skills. That's greenlight.com/ATTWG to get started. greenlight.com/ATTWG. It's summertime, so I'm looking for lighter fabrics, better materials, and pieces that just feel good the moment you put them on. That's why I keep coming back to Quince. They focus on high-quality essentials, breathable linen, soft organic cotton, washable silk, but without the luxury markup. Quince has beautiful everyday pieces like 100% European linen pants, dresses, and tops with styles starting at just $32. And let me tell you, I wore my Quince linen pants yesterday. I absolutely adore them. I can still look polished while staying cool. And I love a deal, so you know that I love the fact that everything at Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. So elevate your summer wardrobe. Go to quince.com/ATTWG for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. Now available in Canada, too. That's quince.com/ATTWG for free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/ATTWG. Once a report was finally taking, a search did get underway, and Noreen's friends jumped into action almost immediately. Within the first week, they were putting up flyers all over Long Island. Because John was a firefighter, his firehouse joined in the search effort, too. Elaine described it, saying, quote, there were family, friends, and police dogs, end quote. At one desperate point, the friends even visited a psychic who told them that Noreen's body was in a park in the Bronx. They went and searched the park, but found nothing. While all of that was going on, there were things that weren't happening, and those things raised some eyebrows. According to Elaine, John did not participate in the search. Now, she finds that suspicious, but I actually will give him a pass on this one. Like, to me, it could go either way. Like, maybe, yes, it is suspicious, but I completely get why a family member would not want to go on a search like that. You know, you don't want to be the one to find your loved one in sort of situation.
And the police don't want you to find them either, because your reaction is probably going to be to go and grab the body, disturb the scene.
Right.
As opposed to somebody that is not that close that would, you know, potentially spot the body, know to stay back and wait for the police to show up.
Right. And I think it's exactly that reason why a lot of times authorities will tell family members specifically, do not go on these searches.
Right.
So, like I said, totally give them a pass on that. And I don't think that that in and of itself, like, makes them look suspicious.
No, a lot of the other stuff already does.
But, yeah, right. But
that by itself does not.
Yeah. He also hired a lawyer immediately, which, you know, again, doesn't look great, but the husband's always going to be the suspect.
Yeah.
So to me, you need to protect yourself in that situation, innocent or not, you know? I think an innocent person absolutely should also be talking to a lawyer if somebody close to you like that goes missing, because police absolutely are going to look at you and you need somebody who's there to protect your rights. Now, where I start to raise an eyebrow is that he also did not allow police to search the apartment, the plumbing supply store, the house that was being renovated, or any other family property that he may have owned.
Okay. Why? I mean,
I don't know. And you know, I will say that I can see his attorney advising him not to allow any searches. But yeah, like, it does.
I mean, that really raises the suspicion.
Yeah, like, that one really doesn't look great.
Like, yeah, let's say his attorney says, retain your right to privacy, don't let them search, whatever. Like, if you're really innocent, you've got to, like, it's not just blind faith on what your attorney is telling you, because your attorney's only looking at things from a legal standpoint. Like, you have to be the one to say, okay, I didn't do anything. They're not going to find anything that's going to implicate me in a crime. So I'm going to let them search the apartment, the house, wherever, you know what I mean?
Yeah. But, you know, you never know, right? Because things can be found that could be misconstrued as evidence of something that didn't happen. It's a risk, you know, it's a risk. But yeah, it definitely does make you look a little bit more suspicious than just hiring a lawyer and not going on the search. Now, the other thing, though, that he didn't do is speak to the press. He didn't hang up flyers. He didn't make impassioned pleas to make sure that people knew his wife was missing. Like, he never tried to keep her story or her face out there. Like, he never spoke about it at all. And I get it from the perspective of, you know, like, I'm going to be looked at in this case. But also, your wife is missing. The mother of your children is missing. And she needs an advocate. And you're not doing it.
But we've also seen family members of missing children not in the forefront of the media.
Yeah. And I think it's a little bit different, too, as the months and the years go on, that you might, as a family member, want to take a step back. Like, it becomes too much.
Yeah.
But like, in those first days, to not go like, oh my gosh, you know, help me find my wife. It's not great.
Yeah.
So beyond that, John completely cut off Noreen's family and stopped allowing them to see the children.
What the hell?
A year after Noreen's disappearance, her sister Susan told News 12 that she had gone from seeing her niece and nephew every day to not being permitted to have any contact with them.
I mean, you probably don't know this, but maybe Noreen's family was accusing John privately of things.
Well, yeah, that's actually exactly what I'm going to get to. So things were so fractured between the two sides that Noreen's parents actually took John to court to try to get custody of Noreen's children. And that hearing prompted one of the very few public statements John has ever made about this case. All right, I'm going to play a clip from 1992. And the people you're going to hear are John Brown and then Noreen's mother, Margot.
The grandmother accuses me of killing my wife in front of my children and has made statements like that to my neighbors in my town, has repeatedly told me that she was going to get my children from me and take them from me.
I never said anything to my son-in-law. God should strike me right here. I never once accused him of anything.
So yeah, according to John, Noreen's family was accusing him.
I mean, if it's gotten to that point, like, I can kind of see him cutting off ties. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Accusing him of killing his wife in front of their kids. Like, that's...
Well, we don't know that happened.
I understand that, but that's what he said. I'm saying if we're to believe him that was happening, then I can totally understand him cutting them out.
Yeah, and I will say that, you know, in that clip we just heard, Margot says that she never did that.
She never did, right.
However, Susan certainly did. And she did so publicly about a year after her sister's disappearance.
I think that some harm has become her. I think that I really don't believe she's alive anymore. I was over there on a daily basis, and I saw them fight daily. They had arguments and fights daily. We have been totally cut off from the kids. We're not allowed to see them anymore. I used to see them every day, and now I can't see them at all. Her husband has denied me every right to visit them. He complained that he was stuck in a bad marriage. And he complained to her best friend that he wasn't going to give her a divorce and she wasn't going to get his kids. And I mean, just everything put together just makes us believe that he had something to do with it.
Okay, so I'm confused. So now this is her sister saying that she witnessed them fighting all the time.
Yeah.
I was under the impression that nobody had seen them fighting. It was just that one occurrence when she told her friend, Elaine, that the marriage wasn't what it appeared to be.
No. So that was the first time Elaine and their friend Kelly found out about it.
Okay.
But Susan, it sounds like, was around every single day. So I think Susan just saw a lot more than Elaine and the friends did.
Got it.
As part of News 12's big 2019 story on this case, we found actual evidence that backs up the claims that not only was John and Noreen's marriage in trouble, but that John was capable of violence. About 11 months prior to her disappearance in early 1990, police were called to John and Noreen's residence. Now, there wasn't much of a report written. It was just one page, a form that was, you know, partially filled out. But under nature of complaint, it says that John had threatened Noreen's life. Even worse, it said that Noreen had an abrasion on her neck.
Mm.
And I don't know what type of abrasion. I don't know, you know, how, because again, there's like no information in this report at all. But if that indicates strangulation, strangulation is a huge indicator of murder.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody strangles you, they're going to kill you. I mean, statistically, you know?
Well, I mean, even more so than that, it's just, it's a very intimate way of delivering pain to somebody.
Right.
It's not the same as like punching them, you know, not that I'm saying that's okay, but you deliver a punch or something like that, it's over in an instant. Like strangulation is slow.
Right. It's prolonged.
And it's close.
Yeah. And again, we don't know that that's right. What that was at all. It only says an abrasion on the neck.
Right. Which could mean anything.
It could. I mean, it could. Depending on where it is, like she could have had her purse on and he could have just like snatched the purse away from her in anger. And that could have like rubbed against her neck and caused an abrasion. Yeah. I mean, it could have been any number of things. But anytime I see anything around the neck, like, yeah, my hackles definitely go up. The matter was referred to family court and Noreen signed off saying that she required no further police assistance. And it seems to have just kind of been dropped after that. So let's get back to the searches for Noreen or lack thereof. When I first read about this case and someone said that they hadn't searched the property around the home, it didn't really strike me as odd because after all, they lived in an apartment. So I would think like, yeah, you definitely want to search the apartment itself, but like how much value is the land around the apartment going to have? It's a public place. But I was wrong because the apartment, you know, again, when I first read about this, I was just picturing an apartment building. As mm-hmm. I mentioned earlier, it was above the plumbing supply store. And there was somewhat of like a backyard almost right behind that plumbing supply store. And in that area right behind the building was a well.
Mm.
Now, I kind of got the impression that it already wasn't a working well in 1990. I think it was an old well that was no longer being used.
It's a good place to hide a body, though.
Yeah, and it was accessible. You know, apparently it was just in grass, like in dirt. You know, you could theoretically get to it.
Well, that's how baby Jessica fell down the well in the 80s.
Yeah. So, you know, it is one of those things that everybody kind of wondered about back in 1990, 1991, but because it was on that private property, it was never searched. In 2019, when Noreen's friends were working with News 12 to jumpstart Noreen's case again, the new owner of the store, who had bought it from John just a few years after Noreen's disappearance, let them look out back. Now, he initially did not want to help at all. So when the reporter showed up, he was like, oh, yeah, no, like, I don't want you guys back there. I don't want you guys coming in. I don't want you looking at anything. You know, like, whatever happened was a long time ago. It doesn't have anything to do with me. And then that's when he kind of dropped that, like, he knows John and, you know, knows his family and all this kind of stuff. So whatever. But later, he did allow two of the friends to go back in the backyard without the reporter and without filming anything. And what they said is that basically the well is gone. They say that sometime after Noreen's disappearance, it was sealed up and buried under concrete.
Mm.
And one friend said that there's actually a building on it now, but I don't know about that.
Mm.
So at the very least, it's under concrete. When asked about the well, the Nassau County Homicide Squad told News 12 that the well was a, quote, place of interest, end quote, and said they were looking into it. But again, because it's under concrete and located on private property, it doesn't appear that any search has ever been done. And, you know, all of this was almost 7 years ago.
Right.
While the efforts from Noreen's friends and family in 2019 did breathe new life into the long dormant case, nothing really happened from a law enforcement perspective. To my knowledge, no searches have been done since then, and John has continuously refused to speak with police or the media, saying that it upsets his two oldest children too much. Two oldest children, you picked up on that. Because sometime in the years after Noreen's disappearance, John remarried and had another son and daughter. They were born around 1997 and 1998. Which is interesting timing because I believe in New York, it does take 7 years to be able to declare somebody dead. I don't know if he was able to get legally divorced prior to that just because she had been gone. But, you know, so it was about 7 years after Noreen's disappearance that they would have gotten married, if not earlier. John Brown has never been charged with anything in connection with Noreen's disappearance. He's never been publicly named as a suspect by police, and he maintains his innocence. In fact, when News 12 spoke with him in 2019, John pushed back on the idea that he had ever obstructed the investigation. He told them police could question him about, quote, anything they want, end quote, and said, quote, I'm not stopping them from doing anything. I've never stopped them from anything other than when they started getting crazy with me and my lawyer got involved, end quote.
Crazy, like asking to do the bare minimum searching of where she lived?
Yeah, I guess. Well, but that's the thing. He says that he allowed police to search his properties and that they came there with dogs. But that is a claim that even to this day, Nassau County police dispute. The two children Noreen left behind, Anthony and Alexa, were too young when their mother vanished to have any memories of her. Though they grew up without her, they grew up with a stepmother and two younger siblings. They also didn't grow up with Noreen's family at all, so it's hard to say what they know or what they believe about their mother's disappearance.
I mean, they probably believe whatever their dad told them.
One thing we do know is that neither of them has ever had any interest in speaking publicly about their mother. In 2018, when an article was written about Noreen in Newsday, Alexa couldn't be reached for comment, while Anthony only said, quote, let's not open wounds, end quote. And listen, I don't want to speculate about what Noreen's children believe about what happened on December 12, 1990. It appears as though they grew up and remained close with their father. But if they do have any questions in the back of their minds, now might be the time to ask. Ethan will tell you, I am so bad at feeding myself, which is why even though I work from home, I have come to love Factor. Because for me, healthy eating isn't a willpower problem, it's a setup problem. Factor has meals that are built around your goals, whether that's weight loss, overall nutrition, more protein, or GLP-1 support. Factor meals are fresh and never frozen. They have over 100 rotating weekly meals, including globally inspired flavors like Mediterranean and Asian, so there's always something new to look forward to. And you have to try their new salads. With vibrant ingredients like elote, corn, and miso edamame, they have this miso edamame tofu salad that I am obsessed with. It's ready in 2 minutes. It's delivered straight to your door. You barely have to think about it, and that's my favorite part. So head to factormeals.com/ATTWG50off and use code ATTWG50off to get 50% off and free daily greens per box with new subscriptions only while supplies last until 9/27/26. See website for more details.
You're listening to this podcast, so I know you've got a curious mind. Here's a helpful fact you might not know yet. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive save over $900 on average. Pop over to progressive.com, answer some questions, and you'll get a quick quote with discounts that are easy to come by. In fact, 99% of their auto customers earn at least one discount. Visit progressive.com and see if you can enjoy a little cash back. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $946 by new customer surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2024 and May 2025. Potential savings will vary.
You should never have to choose between a home that looks great and one that's actually livable. Between pets, kids, spills, some of which are done by my kids, many of which are done by me, the new Ruggable All-in-One Rug delivers premium design with the peace of mind of being machine washable, stain resistant, and non-slip. I came to the conclusion long ago that I need machine washable rugs in my home. And Ruggable has the most beautiful designs, whether it's vintage inspired, neutral, modern, whatever your style is, you will find it at Ruggable. They're stain resistant for everyday spills, but they have a high quality look and feel. And most importantly, they're durable and built for your life. Refresh your home at Ruggable.com. Get 10% off your first order site-wide with promo code ATTWG at Ruggable.com. That's Ruggable.com and use code ATTWG at checkout. Let's talk about John a little bit. One thing that probably influenced the way John is and was viewed by his children is the fact that many people in this country and even around the world would say that he's legitimately a hero. And, you know, that's probably not what you're expecting me to say at this point in the episode, but remember how I said he was a member of FDNY? He joined in 1978 and was assigned to Ladder Company 165 in St. Albans, Queens. He was also one of the thousands of firefighters who responded to the World Trade Center attacks on September 11th, 2001. He was part of the rescue and recovery mission. He also helped with the aftermath and ended up spending between 40 to 50 days in the rubble at Ground Zero. Because of this, he developed a respiratory illness and had to retire from FDNY on September 10, 2002. Despite his retirement, he continued to work as a volunteer firefighter in his town of New Hyde Park and even served as fire commissioner until 2013, though this wasn't without its own controversy. When I was doing my research on this case, I found a 2010 article in the New York Post about John Brown. They must not have known that he had a missing wife because the Post would have been all over that.
Yeah.
Especially in the context of what this article was actually about, which was them basically accusing him of scamming New York taxpayers.
Oh.
Here's an excerpt from the article titled, "He's Got Money to Burn." Quote, "A disabled," in quotes, "city firefighter is still battling blazes while he rakes in a taxpayer-funded pension. Retired FDNY Lieutenant John Brown, who left the department after 9/11 with a tax-free $82,000 disability pension, has responded to hundreds of fires in his Long Island hometown since leaving the FDNY, the Post has learned," end quote. So basically, it went on to kind of give his stats, like how many fires he's responded to in New Hyde Park.
Yeah.
And, you know, basically saying that he's not actually disabled, he shouldn't have gotten this tax-free pension, things like that.
I don't know enough about the differences in, like, medical requirements per fire department. Like, FDNY may have a more strict medical requirement or background.
Yeah.
Then maybe a smaller fire department, and maybe that's why he was able to get, but he was also a volunteer too.
Right. And that's what it sounds like. So if you read the full article in the Post, it does kind of go into that, basically saying that, you know, hey, my doc, like the New Hyde Park doctors cleared me, like they said I was good to go, so I was going to do it.
Yeah.
And he actually spoke to the Post. So, you know, unlike with his wife's disappearance, he was fine to talk to the press, saying, quote, "It's my own decision to go into fires at my own risk with a volunteer organization. I am a fireman. I still believe I can do the job," end quote. Basically, he says that what happened with FDNY is that once they realized that the health of firefighters was being affected by having spent so much time at Ground Zero after the attacks, they started making all of the firefighters who had been there go undergo like more medical tests.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Totally normal. So he said that he did that just like everybody else. And because of that, they uncovered this illness and forced him to retire, even though he still felt that he could serve as a firefighter. And he says he was even like up for captain. Like he did not want to retire. So he was telling the Post, he's like, "Listen, yeah, I got this pension, but that wasn't my goal. Like I would have rather just stay on the job." So while he couldn't stay with FDNY, he did serve with New Hyde Park for the next decade. But here's how this relates to what I said before the break, that now might be the time for his two oldest kids to start asking questions if they have them.
Because that respiratory illness is coming back?
It already came back.
Yeah.
In November 2025, John Brown died. And according to one obituary, it was from his World Trade Center-related illness. He was 67 years old. Shortly after Noreen's disappearance, John moved out of the apartment he shared into the home that he was renovating. As I mentioned earlier, he sold the plumbing business a few years later, so the family doesn't own that building, but they do still own the home on Falmouth Avenue and any secrets that it may hold. But they might not be interested. They've lived their entire lives without their biological mother. Maybe they just want to leave it in the past and not confront what could potentially be some awful truths. With that said, when you look at the circumstances of Noreen's disappearance, where the car was parked, the fact that no one could place her at Pathmark, the fact that she's never shown up in the interceding decades, the history of domestic violence, it's kind of difficult for me, a layperson, to see how the police didn't, and apparently still don't, have probable cause to do any searches on their own. Because I'm looking, just from direct experience, I'm looking at the Mom to Kafla case, which, you know, as all of you know, I've been following since day one. M&S's Park didn't really have much more on Naresh than,
right,
than Nassau County had on John Brown. And they were able to get a search warrant. And once they got that search warrant, what did they find? They found blood. They found, you know, a saw that also had blood on it. Like, they found all of these things,
right,
that then strengthened the case and allowed them to make an arrest, right? So, like, I get that they don't have enough evidence to arrest this man for anything. I mean, obviously before he died. But, like, so, I mean, I very much understand that. The part I'm struggling with is how they didn't believe they had probable cause to even have a single search warrant.
Yeah, that's astounding to me as well.
I'm not a cop. You are, but this is not your
my area.
Area at all.
No.
You know, maybe there is some very good reason that we're both missing.
I mean, I could potentially see, you know, a DA or even, you know, a detective in the police department saying, well, you know, that judge is never going to go for it because we need more or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Initially.
Yeah.
But it's been how many years?
30 years. Like, I mean, 35 years.
Judges come and go all the time. Not to say that you should, you know,
judge shop,
but like
over 35
when
years.
When a
like,
judge leaves
on.
The bench,
yeah,
you could potentially bring up the case and say, hey, we want to search that well out back.
Yeah. But it doesn't appear as though that's ever been done. As for the theories of what happened to Noreen Brown, there are the usual possibilities. No one seems to think she left voluntarily, but oddly enough, the circumstances of Noreen's disappearance are pretty similar to another case that has been in the news recently, Michelle Hundley Smith. She's the North Carolina mom who went out to buy Christmas presents on December 9th, 2001, and never came home. She vanished, leaving behind her husband and three children. Then, 24 years later, in February 2026, authorities located her. She was living a new life in another town, still in North Carolina. So, you know, as always, anything is possible.
Yeah.
But most people close to Noreen don't believe that she's out there. They believe that she was murdered on December 12th, 1990. But the question is, by whom? John and presumably those close to him believe it was a stranger abduction. Someone grabbed her at or near the Pathmark that night and took her. After all, Noreen's car pulling into the lot but no one remembering seeing her inside does allow for the possibility of something happening in that parking lot. Here's what John had to say about this when a reporter came to his door in 2019.
Okay. Can you just tell me what you think happened to her? Do you think she's alive?
No, I don't think she's alive.
Okay.
I think she was murdered. That's what I think. And we just haven't ever found her.
Murdered, but when she went to the Pathmark?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Right. There was a report that a lady seen an argument there.
Okay.
Okay. That came out about 2 weeks later. But nothing ever turned up from it.
Between her and a man?
Two men.
Two men.
Mm-hmm.
Was there a description of those men or any video?
You got to get, yes, but I was not involved in it. My fire department friends who were out searching at the time turned it over to the police and the lady over, and I don't know what came of it.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
His firefighter buddies found a woman that said that she remembers hearing two men arguing in the parking lot.
Two men arguing with a woman in the parking lot. And yeah, Elaine told the same reporter that either he made that claim at the time or, you know, one of the firefighters made that claim at the time. She says she does remember hearing about that, the claim.
The claim, right.
But she has no idea if that's true. And Nassau police have said that they've never been able to confirm this account of anybody being in the Pathmark parking lot having an argument.
Even if a woman, even if this is true, like, and a woman heard some people arguing in the parking lot around that time, and let's say that that information was turned over to the police, he seems very lackadaisical about it. He was just like, I don't know anything about that. I had nothing to do with it.
Yeah. That part really got me, where he was like, yeah, I didn't have anything to do with it, or that didn't have anything to do with me, or whatever he said there.
Right.
Like, that part, I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, this is...
Like, there's a potential suspect in your wife's disappearance / murder.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, I don't know.
I don't know. Doesn't really have anything to do with me. Yeah. Like, what?
Right.
That's insane. Because you're right. I mean, even if you believe him, like, yes, this happened. Like, yes, even if you believe him, like, that he believes it happened, and then you go the step further and say that it's true.
Why wouldn't you as the husband be, like, up the cop's ass about it?
Yeah.
Or talking about it to the media.
Publicly, exactly. Yes. Yeah, the that doesn't have anything to do with me statement was... Of everything that he said on that doorstep, like, that was so telling to me.
Yeah.
Now, of course, there's also no actual evidence pointing to a stranger because that statement had never been confirmed. There's no struggle reported at the scene. Nothing was taken. There was no demand, no ransom. And plus, the car was found locked with the presents still inside, which, again, doesn't really fit with her being, like, ambushed at her car by a stranger.
Right. At least if robbery was the motive.
Yeah, if robbery was the motive.
It was just straight up kidnapping, sure.
Yeah.
It is interesting and rather convenient to fit with his story that she only took cash with her. Like, didn't bring a purse that could have been dropped if there had been a struggle.
Well, she did bring her purse. She did bring her purse.
Was the purse in the car?
Yeah.
Again, also convenient for his story.
Yeah.
And, like... That's the other thing. Like, I mean, why would you bring your purse and leave it in your car if you're going shopping?
Right. I guess, you know, his theory was that she didn't make it. Something happened beforehand. But then, like, why was the purse in the car?
Right.
Exactly. Yeah.
None of that makes sense.
No.
And she definitely didn't make it into the store because no employee remembers seeing her.
Right.
Which, that's fine. Like,
but at 11 p.m., I think they would have.
Yeah. They would have, but also, you know, she never made it back to the car.
Yeah.
Because there were no grocery bags in
right.
the car.
No. The third possibility, of course, is that Noreen never made it out of the house that night, and the person responsible was someone she knew. Friends have described a troubled marriage and a woman who wanted out. Noreen's own sister went to News 12 in the early 90s and said she believed John had killed her. There was a, quote, minor argument the very night she disappeared. And the next morning, the first call John made was to Elaine, not the police. And then he sent her to be the one to find Noreen's car. Friends and family say that John never publicly searched for his missing wife or appealed to the media. He hired an attorney and declined to allow police onto his properties. And a well on one of those properties has been called a place of interest by Nassau County Homicide, and as far as we know, has never been searched. The only reason we can even talk about Noreen this week on the show is really because of her friends and her family and the effort that they've put in over the years. So I want to end there because it's a part of this case that, you know, can actually give you some hope. For years, Noreen's disappearance had essentially gone quiet. And in 2005, her mother died without ever knowing what happened to her daughter. Then, around 2018, her old Uniondale High School class held their 40-year reunion. Her classmates got to talking. They realized that nobody had ever found out what happened to Noreen, that the case had simply gone cold and stayed there. So they got to work. They reached out on social media. They peppered the Nassau County Police Department with requests for information. They worked with Noreen's friend Elaine and her sister to push the case back into the spotlight. And it was that renewed pressure that led to that in-depth News 12 story that I've been talking about throughout this episode. But as amazing as all of that is, there's still been very little movement from the police, at least not publicly. December 13th, 2025 would have been Noreen's 67th birthday. Her son Anthony and her daughter Alexa are in their 30s now, older than their mother ever got to be. Somewhere out there is the answer to what happened to Noreen Higuchi Brown on the night before her 32nd birthday. Somebody knows, and her friends, after 35 years, are still asking. Noreen Higuchi Brown has been missing from New Hyde Park, New York, since December 12, 1990. She's a biracial woman of Japanese and German descent, with brown hair and brown eyes. She was last seen wearing a dark-colored wool coat, red slacks, and white sneakers. Noreen was one day shy of her 32nd birthday when she went missing. She would be 67 today. If you have any information about the disappearance of Noreen Higuchi Brown, please contact the Nassau County Police Department at 516-573-8800. For ongoing updates, her supporters still maintain the Find Noreen Facebook page. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos on our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at @ATTWGPod on Instagram and TikTok. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
And we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. All research, writing, and editing is done by me, Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketsa. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!